Hi again, everybody. This is Mark Movsesian. I'm the co-director at the Center for Law and Religion at St. John's. I'm joined once again by the center's co-director, my friend and colleague, Mark DiGirolami, for an episode of Legal Spirits, which is our podcast series on issues and cases in law and religion. You can find past episodes on Apple iTunes and also archived on our website, Law and Religion Forum. That's one word, lawandreligionforum.org. Well, today, Mark, we're delighted to have with us a guest, Carter Sneed. Carter is a professor of law and also a professor of political science, as well as the director of the DeNicola Center for Ethics and Culture at the University of Notre Dame. And he is also the author of a new book from Harvard University Press, What It Means to Be Human, about public bioethics. And Carter is actually going to be the guest in our colloquium here at St. John's, the colloquium at Law and Religion next week. And he's very kindly agreed to speak with us a little bit about his book today. So Mark, hello to you, and Carter, hello to you as well.
Hi, great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you, Carter. It's a real pleasure for us and an honor.
Let me just say how much I admire the Center for Law and Religion, and what you guys are doing is absolutely indispensable to the academic discourse, but also to the public discourse around these important questions. And this podcast is one of my very favorite podcasts. So thank you. It's a great pleasure and treat for me to join you.
Well, you can
thank you
time, Carter, after a start like that. But actually, we're in admiration. This is a mutual admiration society. We're all in great admiration of the center that you run. We've been guests there for conferences. We've seen the kind of operation that you put together and the wonderful things that you offer there. And so this is a real treat for us as well.
Excellent.
So let's start in, Carter. We'll talk a little bit. We got a few questions for you about the book. So the book is called What It Means to Be Human. And I think it's fair to say that the core argument of the book is that American bioethics is grounded in a particular anthropology about what human beings are. So maybe you could just spend a little time talking about what you mean by anthropology. And do you think American law generally internalizes its own anthropology enough? Do you think it ignores anthropology and in the grounding of rights? Or how do you see the relationship of anthropology and American law generally?
Yeah, no, thanks for the question. So the book makes two claims, as you've said. It makes a methodological claim about the best way into understanding law and public policy. And I've always maintained, and I think you guys probably agree, the richest way to understand any legal or policy question is to drill down into the normative structure of the law itself and to ask the question, what is this law aiming to promote? What is this law aiming to avoid? What are the principles of justice, principles of equality and freedom that are underwriting the doctrines? But the book seeks to go a level deeper still and ask the question, what vision of the human person and human flourishing is assumed by the law, since all law, if it's to be intelligible at all, is aimed at promoting and protecting the flourishing of persons. That's what law is for. And if law is for persons, it must have a kind of ex ante operating premise about what a person is and what human flourishing is. And so what I tried to do in the book is to uncover, and that's what I'm calling anthropology, to your question specifically. It's not anthropology in the sort of modern academic sense of Margaret Mead going to faraway islands to report on the lives of distant peoples, but rather in its kind of literal sense, it's an account of what it means to be human. Really what Walker Percy meant when he said, Catholic novelist Walker Percy, that everyone has an anthropology, everyone has an operating premise about what a person is and in what his or her flourishing consists. And when I turned my attention to what I call the vital conflicts of American public bioethics, the public policy and legal questions about abortion, assisted reproductive technology, and end-of-life decision-making, issues in which questions of religious liberty obviously emerge quite frequently, as you guys have discussed on your podcast, when I analyzed those, the state of the law, to ask the question, what vision of the person is this rooted in, what I found was that it very closely tracks what Robert Bella, author of Habits of the Heart from 1985, American social scientist who studied sort of American self-understanding in the latter part of the 20th century, and then deepened further by Charles Taylor, Catholic philosopher. It's a vision of the human person that identifies the person solely with his or her will or her desire. It defines the person by their capacity to make choices and to interrogate the interior of the self, to find authentic and original truths, and then to configure your destiny and your life accordingly and conceives of the fundamental personal reality as an atomized individual will, not a will.
Carter, yeah. This is what you talk about as expressive individualism, right?
Absolutely. This is expressive individualism. It's expressive in the sense that flourishing is determined by one's self-investigation and expression of one's deepest, authentic, original truth. And it's individualism because it takes individuals to be atomized, solitary units.
Yeah, and Carter, you don't talk about this all that much in the book, but when I read that chapter on expressive individualism, I was reminded a lot of the so-called rise of the nuns, which is taking place across America today, because this new spirituality of the nuns, the idea that, you know, every person can for him or herself come up with the ideal religious path, and or I should say actually the ideal spiritual path, and that really we oughtn't to be bound by tradition, which in fact is stultifying and gets in the way of human flourishing. It seems to me that what you are describing is in fact the new theology of the nuns in a way. Do you think that's right?
You know, I think that's very, very much on point. And in fact, in Bella's work, he coined a phrase, Sheilaism, describing a particular respondent in his social science survey, a woman named Sheila, who basically described her own flourishing in precisely those terms, her spiritual flourishing, as in finding her own pathway based on her own interior authentic truths.
Right. Yes. Sheilaism is right. That's Robert Bella. And we talked about that a lot in our seminar over the years.
Yeah. So, and yeah, please go ahead.
No, go ahead, Carter, please.
No. I was just going to say that the fundamental point here is that in the areas of, and I just want to make it clear, I'm not talking about human beings' decision-making, although the law shapes decision-making and even people's understanding of justice. But when I'm talking about the anthropology that animates these areas, I'm talking about the anthropology that roots and grounds the legal doctrines and the policies, looking at American abortion jurisprudence on the question of abortion or the absence of any meaningful law or regulation with regard to assisted reproductive technology and the laws touching and concerning end of life decision making. So when I say expressive individualism is the animating vision of the person, I'm talking about assumed by the legal structures, not necessarily assumed by the people in making their own choices for these different pathways.
Mark?
Well, I was going to say, and if that's the case, then I think it's fair to say your book is a critique of expressive individualism. So maybe you want to talk a little bit about why you think it's a problem. And then I have a second question too, which is, how are you going to fight it? Because that really is deeply, deeply ingrained in America, even aside from the nuns, it's deeply, deeply ingrained in kind of the American experience.
Now, the reason that it's a flawed anthropology, first of all, I don't say that it's utterly false, right? It is true that we're free and that we're particular in our experience of ourselves and our experience of one another. We're individuated selves. And so I'm not saying that a sort of a collectivist vision is what's needed here. What the fundamental problem with expressive individualism as a grounding, an anthropological grounding for American public bioethics, is that it fails to take seriously our individual and shared lives as embodied beings. That is, it's a purely, this is what Percy called sort of angelism, right? The idea of a person as a mere will, and everything else is kind of accidental and instrumental, right? The body is an instrument to pursuing the projects of the will. Our relationships are instrumental to pursuing projects of the will. Nature itself, the world around us. It's a very extractive kind of posture, both towards our own bodies and those around us. And it's precisely the wrong anthropology to ground laws that are meant to be protective of vulnerable people whose vulnerability in the context of bioethics emerges precisely from their embodiment, and frequently the conditions of their embodiment making sort of autonomy or the assertion of the unencumbered will impossible, right? So we're talking about people suffering from dementia, people who are nearing the end of their lives, people with disabilities, small children, unborn children. We're talking about the population of individuals to whom public bioethics seeks to protect can't even give an account of why such people are within the moral and legal community because they can't do the things that define what persons do. They can't interrogate their own depths and project their own future and pursue their good as they see it. And so if you're going to devise, just take a small example, in the context of end-of-life decision-making, if the person who has lost their cognitive capacity for choice and is on and dependent on life-sustaining measures, if that's the person that we aim to serve with public bioethics, and we project onto that person's vision of an individuated self whose highest flourishing is making choices and blazing their own pathway, that's a fundamental incommensurability between the reality of that person is living and this false image that we're projecting onto them and constructing protections that are appropriate to that false vision. A person who goes to the doctor is not going to the doctor to assert his or her unencumbered will. A person goes to the doctor because you're sick and you need help and you're vulnerable because we're embodied. We have corruptible bodies, we're vulnerable, we're mutually dependent, and we are subject to these natural limits. And the law needs to, in its construction of the image of the person, has to take that into account. And that's why expressive individualism fundamentally is inadequate in very, very dangerous ways for public bioethics.
So one question I have about this, it goes to Mark's second question that he asked you is, you know, he sort of said, well, it's in the water, right? And in some ways it's in the philosophical sort of ethos, right? I mean, so the issue of mind-body dualism runs deep in the liberal tradition, goes back a number of years. And I mean, I think more broadly, I wondered in reading the book whether there is a kind of strong undercurrent of just sort of a critique of liberalism, right? I mean, so this is, you know, you don't come out and say so quite, you know, in those kinds of terms in the book, but these are really some of the fundamental suppositions of liberalism. And I wonder where you stand on that, Carter.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Now, obviously, my friend Pat Dineen is in my mind when I'm thinking about these things and talking about it. He is obviously a thoroughgoing critique of liberalism. He thinks it's basically rotten to the core based on its anthropological assumptions about radical individualism and human flourishing. I don't quite go that far in the book. I really do focus my analysis on expressive individualism, which is not clear to me. And again, I'm out of my depth when I sort of wander into this conversation, but it's not clear to me that expressive individualism is the anthropology that roots the founding generation. Right. I mean, Bella himself draws a distinction between John Locke's approach and which he calls utilitarian individualism, which is really about harnessing an array of individual preferences. And Adam Smith does a similar thing under a well-regulated system of laws for the benefit of the common good. Right. To try to create a system in which everyone benefits, whereas expressive individualism doesn't care about everyone benefiting. Expressive individualism is single-mindedly focused on the atomized individual. It's closer to Hobbes, I think, than Locke in that way, where Hobbes really was a radical atomized individualist. But even Hobbes, though, had a kind of sense of trying to harness that reality for a shared, you know, outcome that I think is missing from expressive individualism.
And Carter, just to follow up on that, as I read what you've written and also, of course, Charles Taylor, on whom you rely, and Bella, whom you've mentioned, really expressive individualism sort of comes out of the Romantic movement in the 19th century. It really isn't the framers. It's a little later. And then by the 20th century, Taylor says it becomes kind of mainstream. And that's the real difference. So it might not be liberalism. On the other hand, to get back to just the question I had before, it does seem like it's us today. And so it's, you know, very hard in a way to push back against that.
It's true. And I'll say, and, you know, Roscoe Pound and others noticed the strong strains of individualism that run through American and Anglo.
And Tocqueville. Tradition.
Yeah, absolutely. And so there's a lot of deep roots with respect to individualism. I think expressive individualism, because it's ultimately so inhuman, and Taylor talks about this, and Solzhenitsyn talks about it, and McIntyre as well, you can't really live as an expressive individualist. Eventually, you become disoriented, and being on a blank slate is kind of runs contrary to what we are, as McIntyre says, as sort of storytelling animals. You have to have a narrative and a history to even orient who you are. In fact, expressive individualism itself requires another person to receive your expressions of who you are, and to even refine your own self-understanding. So expressive individualism, I think, is a kind of impossibility and a kind of, and so what happens is people become disoriented, and then they become, Bella thought and Taylor thinks, easy prey to despotism and sort of totalitarian impulses. And someone recently suggested in conversation that the kind of move towards radical identity politics could be a sort of reaction against the dislocation and disorientation of expressive individuals.
Yeah, we were, you know, so you're going to find out next week when you talk to our students that we talked about that in our class too. Are the sort of new identitarian movements, which are very collective. You know, you might think of Black Lives Matter, or you might think of the Me Too movement, which are really not individualist. No. They are really collective movements. And, you know, is this a resistance to expressive individualism, or is it, as you just suggested, is this a kind of natural outgrowth of expressive individualism?
Yeah, I tend to think the latter. I mean, I don't think folks can live long. It takes a Nietzsche or something to actually really live as an most people don't have the kind of internal probably resources. I want to be neutral. I don't think it's good virtues that would lead one to be, you know, they say you're either a beast or a god if you can be, you know, completely solitary and individuated in that way. I do think that we see, and my reason for optimism ultimately in trying to reorient law and policy in our public discourse and even our normal human interactions with other people that are close to us away from expressive individualism is because it is so contrary to our lived experience if we reflect on it. We know that our embodiment is integral to our human is our experience of ourselves and one another. It's essential. It's not the only thing. Again, I don't want to go the other direction and sort of towards animalism and say we're just sort of meat machines or whatever. I mean, I want to suggest that a genuinely balanced vision of the person that includes acknowledging our freedom and our particularity, but also the entailments of our embodiment is essential for healthy living and certainly for a just, humane regime of the law. And I think because it's so inhuman, I'm given grounds for some optimism for turning things around.
So you've got, Carter, a very interesting chapter that we read together for our class on assisted reproductive technology, which is a sort of you have a number of, you have a chapter on abortion, you have a chapter on ART, you have a chapter on dying. But this chapter you assigned us, and you know, a lot of lawyers know a lot about, or at least know a little bit about, if not a lot about, the law of abortion. You study it in constitutional law and the substantive due process part of the program, and just a lot of people just generally have some familiarity with that law. But a lot less, including lawyers, know about ART. I mean, you really have to take a bioethics course to learn anything about this. So could you describe what the landscape looks like with respect to ART and how it interacts with, or how your thesis interacts with it?
Yeah, absolutely. So this was something we worked a lot on when I was the general counsel to President Bush's Council on Bioethics. We wrote a report called Reproduction and Responsibility, the Regulation of New Technologies, which was entirely about assisted reproduction, and especially as it came into contact with genomic techniques, right? Pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, that is using genetic screening to identify certain disfavored traits or favored traits in vitro embryos before you transfer them to initiate a pregnancy. And the landscape hasn't changed. That report came out in 2004, and my book in chapter four, I think it is, chapter three, that deals with the question of assisted reproductive technology, it's basically the same landscape. The short answer is there's virtually no regulation of assisted reproductive technologies and the practice of fertility care in the United States outside, other than the framework for the regulation of the practice of medicine, which is primarily focused on licensure and certification, which occurs at the outset of an individual practitioner's career. It's renewed occasionally or whatever, or on a regular basis. But if you're licensed and certified to practice medicine, the law in almost every respect appropriately gives you maximal leeway to use your creativity, your own ingenuity. And as you know, Mark, as a person who teaches torts, as long as you're within the standard of care, right? I mean, there's not an ongoing regulatory agency that's responsible for monitoring the practice of medicine in the United States.
It's basically malpractice actions, right?
Right, which
is exactly about experts, right? I mean, when you're dealing with experts, that's the standard of care, unlike actually for non-professional industries.
Right, it's custom. It's custom, contrary to what Learned Hand taught us in the...
I just like to make a plug for my own 1L course, because it's really a contract regime. And we actually do, when I have time in contracts, I do try to look at some of these cases involving contracts about what to do with assisted reproductive technology, particularly with the disposition of pre-embryos. So it's not only torts, it's also contract. But anyway, it's private law. It's not public regulation.
You know, Mark,
and Carter, it's really weird, I thought, actually, that when you compare the abortion regime, which is so, it's so highly regulated by comparison with this one, that it's, why do you think that is, that there's so little regulation here?
Well, I think, let me just say something real quick, one thing to Mark. I don't know if you knew about the history of the word pre-embryo. The word pre-embryo was invented to try to make the embryo, the living embryonic human being, seem less continuous with the child in the womb and the child who is later born. The word pre-embryo is in fact a political term that is not a scientific term. It's adopted by certain scientific authorities for the political reasons. But it is just
in my own defense, it is the word that comes up in the cases.
No question about it. I just, for your listeners, I thought they would knowing there's a very interesting history in the sort of torture of terminology. And pre-embryo is one of the most shameful examples of manipulating terminology to create moral confusion. But put that to the side. So medicine is not regulated very heavily in an ongoing way, except by medical malpractice, licensure and certification. So assisted reproductive technology occurs in that context. The Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, which governs the uses of drugs, devices, and biological products, specifically forbids the regulation of the practice of medicine. It's meant to regulate manufacturers of products and to make sure that they're labeled appropriately and that they're safe and efficacious for their labeled purpose. And so there's not really a well-designed regulatory framework to even ask questions about the well-being of gamete donors, that is these egg donors, these women who undergo certain hormonal therapies, which are not without risks. And then these eggs are harvested, and then the conception of the embryos in the lab, how that's not really regulated. And then the gestational period's not regulated. And the purposes for when, even this is sort of more to the point, how many embryos can be created and transferred is not regulated, unlike in Europe and other places. And other kinds of concerns about the well-being of women and the babies who are later born are not the object of any systematic or comprehensive regulatory regime. And so as a result, we have sex selection. 90% of IVF clinics offer pre-implantation genetic diagnosis for sex selection. And I think we can guess who the beneficiary of that are and who are the female embryos that are discarded and the male embryos that are transferred, as well as a budding industry in choosing embryos and gametes for the sake of non-medical traits like eye color, hair color, skin tone. And even there's a company out in California that is doing analysis and says that they're close to offering analysis for IQ on these embryos. And there's literally no law in place to allow us to slow things down, to even collect data.
So, Mark, I know you have something you want to ask, but I want to make sure we get to this, because a number of our students made this point, Carter, which is, well, you've talked about these very difficult, almost horrible things you're describing, sex selection and this, but on the other hand, IVF actually has helped many couples have children. And so there is an upside. And so at least several of our students in our class, they're going to ask you about this next week. Yeah. So I don't know if you want to respond to that before Mark asks his question.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And so the point of the book is not to argue against IVF as such or fertility treatment as such. And in fact, I think that that very argument supports what I'm saying in the book. That is to say, when people go to fertility clinics, they're not going to assert their unencumbered will, right? They're not going to create some, in fact, we had the most extraordinary thing. In fact, I'll read you right now two quotes from the beginning of that chapter. It's on assisted reproductive technology. One is from a man named John Robertson, who is recently passed away in the past couple of years, was really the godfather of the law of assisted reproductive technologies in the United States. He was on many, many federal advisory commissions. He was the chairman of the ethics commission of the most important professional society for fertility medicine in the country, the American Society for Reproductive Medicine. And in his book, Children of Choice, in 1994, and he reiterated this point in the decades that followed, he thought that reproductive technologies, and this now I'm quoting, are means to achieve or avoid the reproductive experiences that are central to personal conceptions of meaning and identity. And then I coupled that with a quote from a man named Jerry Shatton, who was a scientist at University of Pittsburgh at the time, who worked in pre-implantation genetic diagnosis and different kinds of embryo manipulation. And we gave him 6 weeks to come up with a sentence or two explaining what he thought the purpose of these genetic interventions were. And he said, after 6 weeks of reflection, reproductive medicine is helping prospective parents to realize their own dreams for a disease-free legacy. Now, I don't think that is how parents or people, prospective IVF patients, think when they go to an IVF clinic. And that's precisely why it's bad that the legal framework is anchored in an anthropology that reflects that version of flourishing, right? It's a kind of vision that provides a maximal freedom to do precisely what Robertson and Shatton are talking about without any guardrails to provide for the well-being of the parents involved, of the gamete donors involved, of gestational surrogates, and most of all, for the children who are ultimately born with the aid of these technologies. People go to see a fertility doctor because they feel like their body has betrayed them in becoming the thing that they most want to be, and that's a parent. But the concept of parent is a relational concept. It's not an expressive individual concept. It's a concept that requires the existence of a child. And so the law should be built with that relationship in mind. And what I argue in the book, what the law is not doing now because of its false anthropology, and what it should be doing is to be constructed in a way that when we embark upon fertility treatments, the goal at every stage of that process has to be kept in mind that the goal is to produce a child, to conceive a child who will be welcome and loved unconditionally by her parents. That would be grounding. Now, how that works out and what's allowed and not allowed and what kinds of practices would we restrict or regulate or forbid, those are questions for another time. My argument is that that should be the end of any system of regulation for fertility care that results in the production of a living human being.
So I have, this is very, very interesting, Carter, and listening to you, some parts of your book, you show your intellectual influences, you know, so some parts are more Taylor oriented, Charles Taylor, sometimes a lot of the book is heavily, no surprise, McIntyre influenced. But this part of the book I thought was especially Sandel influenced, and that in particular, the Case Against Perfection book. And I remember years ago when I taught Catholic social thought, I would use parts of Sandel's book, even though he's not a Catholic, there's a lot that he has in common with Catholic social thought on these kinds of questions. And one question that always surfaced for students is, and this is a distinction that he makes, and I wonder, because it's reflected in some of your comments, the distinction between helping or remedying versus sort of selecting something for that is not necessary. So there is a kind of undercurrent, or perhaps it's an overcurrent, of what's natural or what's healthy or naturally healthy in your book, as opposed to what's unnatural or what is unnecessary. And one of the, this is, I think you can see it in Sandel, but one of the questions that this raised is, how do we distinguish between the two?
Yeah, so I think I agree that Michael Sandel and his Atlantic piece, by the way, his Atlantic piece was based on a working paper he did for the President's Council on Bioethics and was part of a larger conversation that we were having that culminated in the report called Beyond Therapy, which is about enhancement and the central question being, how do you distinguish medicine or therapy from enhancement? And the answer is, well, it depends on how you define health, right? And the person, even more than Michael Sandel, that influences me in this context is Leon Cass. Leon Cass, and I think Michael Sandel would say that Leon Cass also influences him in this respect. Michael is great, and I think he's very, and for someone with Michael's profile and also ideological point of view to make these arguments was absolutely indispensable. And we should all be grateful to him for doing that. And I'm grateful for him for his influence on my own thinking. But the question of the therapy enhancement distinction and what constitutes health is really a Leon Cass question, right? Like that, this is the question that Leon Cass, a man who's trained in science, PhD in molecular biology from Harvard, MD from the University of Chicago, trained in medicine, practicing, teaching humanities for decades and decades at Chicago. Also, by the way, early at my alma mater, St. John's College in Annapolis, Maryland, in the early 1970s. This is the question, and Leon talks about defining health. And by the way, this matters for law, right? If you want to be reimbursed for an under your insurance policy, you know, if you're seeking an enhancement versus a medically necessary procedure, that turns on the definition of health. So this isn't simply an academic question. This cashes out in a very concrete way in the law, in health law, and in insurance law. But so the fundamental point here, though, is expressive individualism is most problematic when it insinuates itself into the definition of health, because the only definition of health that makes sense under the auspices of expressive individualism is something that subjectively serves my desires, right? And you imagine these people who have body dysmorphias where they say, I only feel whole if my arm is amputated, right? And doctors, we have enough right now within the tradition of medicine itself to resist that idea, because the object of medicine is to restore and minister to health. But the more health becomes subjectivized and influenced by expressive individualism, you end up with a situation where a doctor is just a service provider and without any judgment as a professional as to how to serve the ends of health, which Cass and others say should be focused on a kind of domain of natural flourishing, right? It should be a baseline of natural flourishing to which we restore people to, or at least get as close as we possibly can, as opposed to defined by the desire of the individual. And for you guys in your work in religious freedom, this matters a whole lot, right? You go to the doctor and you ask for contraception, you ask for an abortion, or to a pharmacist, you ask them to fill your prescription for the abortion pill. The idea that those professions are aimed administering to health matters a lot, and they have no ground to stand on if they're just a service provider and you're just a customer and you come in and they only have a ministerial task of filling out the prescription that you want, right? I mean, that seems to me to matter for religious freedom as much as it does for bioethics.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. Well, Carter, this has been a great discussion. I wish we could go on longer, but we want to save something for the colloquium. And also, we're running up against a limit here. So let me just say thank you again very much, Carter, for coming in and talking with us. It's been a great pleasure having you here today.
Me too. Thank you so much, guys.
Great. And for everyone else, this is Mark Movsesian with my friend and colleague, Mark DiGirolami. This has been another episode of Legal Spirits, our podcast series on issues and cases in law and religion. You can find past episodes archived on iTunes or also at our website, lawandreligionforum.org. That's it for today. See you next time.